Hello, I'm Kirk Bennett. This is number 0219, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0219. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Beverly Gray, a former story editor for legendary producer-director Roger Corman. She has written a book called Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers.
Roger's movies were never snooty. They were never pompous in any way. They were smart, but not intellectual, if you understand what I mean. They were full of excitement, some humor, some attractive women taking their clothes off, things that are certainly still with us.
Jay Pedno is the author of Afterlife, True Tales of the Wandering Dead.
Elmer McGurdy was an outlaw at the turn of the last century, early 1900s. He was shot down by police. He was embalmed by the local funeral home and placed in their window as kind of an example of their craftsmanship. What happened after that, though, was a circus owner came by, purchased the body, and began displaying it. From 1911 onwards, Elmer McGurdy passed hands. He appeared in a couple of films, appeared in different dime museums, things like that. And then at some point, people just kind of forgot that Elmer was a real person.
Mark Prey is the author of When It Comes to Spooning, I'm a Fork. Where did the title come from?
Early on in my marriage, my wife would try to, one way or another, get me to spoon with her to go to sleep at night. What I discovered quickly was that I could not fall asleep like that, and so I started making excuses to avoid the dreaded spooning position, and eventually I just blurted out one night, you know, maybe the problem is that you're a spoon and I'm a fork and we just don't fit together correctly. And after she punched me and rolled over and went to sleep, you know, I knew that was going to be another story.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0219, was Kirk Bennett, a cinematographer and an entertainer. You can check out his websites at nitroband.com and also kirkandmona.com. And you'll find the links to those websites on my website at thestufffile.com on the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0219, which you just heard Kirk say. Thank you very much, Kirk, for doing the guest slate on this program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, Sweden police say they are investigating a man's allegations a woman stole from his apartment and slapped him with a fish while he was sleeping. Investigators say the man, who was in his 60s, called authorities to report he was awakened from a nap by a slap across the face from a woman wielding a mackerel. The man also alleged the woman stole $310 from him and took food from his refrigerator. The woman, who is also in her 60s, is known to the man, police say. They might have lived together sometimes, says Mikael Larsson, a police spokesperson. The incident is being investigated as an assault. Slapped with a fish. I wonder if she did it just for the halibut. Yeah. Moving right along, a Florida woman accused of stabbing her boyfriend when his dog ate her marijuana told police the man repeatedly walked into her knife. Yeah, I've heard that one before. The Broward Sheriff's Office said Shade Scott, age 26, allegedly attacked her boyfriend, Kevin Wiggins, with a knife Sunday at her Dania Beach apartment because his dog had eaten her supply of marijuana. Wiggins suffered small knife cuts to his face and head. He had one large gash across his hand, according to deputies. The arrest report said Scott told deputies Wiggins had walked into her knife repeatedly during their argument. Scott was arrested on a domestic battery charge and jailed in lieu of $2,500 bond. You know, I know this is a serious situation, but have you noticed that nobody is reporting on just how high the dog got? I mean, that's what I want to know. Moving right along, during the politically motivated government shutdown, the left-leaning public policy polling surveyed Americans to see what they thought of Congress in general. The legislators didn't fare very well, with only an 8% favorable rating. Voters reported they felt significantly more support for hemorrhoids than Congress. Other things they preferred over Congress included jury duty, the Department of Motor Vehicles, witches, toenail fungus, cockroaches, and dog poop. But lawmakers can take heart. They scored higher than Russian President Vladimir Putin, New York mayoral candidate and unstoppable sexter Anthony Weiner, and of course, twerking. As my optimistic high school guidance counselor used to say, well, there's always room for improvement with these scores. And it started when a man visited the apartment of Newton County, Georgia Sheriff Deputy Darrell Mathis. There, the man later told police he saw large bags of what he believed to be marijuana on the table. Mathis allegedly sold a man some pot, saying he wasn't afraid of getting caught because, quote, he drives safely and flashes police credentials to get out of tickets if stopped. The FBI started a sting operation, allegedly buying increased amounts of pot from Mathis. Eventually, two undercover agents met with Mathis, where he allegedly flashed his badge and told the agents, "Don't worry, I'm on your side." Mathis allegedly agreed to run marijuana and cocaine and was arrested and charged with possession of marijuana with intent to distribute and with carrying a firearm during a drug offense. This defendant used his position as a police officer to openly violate the very laws he was sworn to uphold, according to U.S. Attorney Sally Yates. Selling marijuana out of his police car while wearing a badge and uniform is outrageous. This case is a reminder that no one is above the law. Oh, you mean cops don't actually get out of tickets by flashing their badges? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Justin Baker, age 20, of Boynton Beach, Florida, has been arrested four times this year for selling drugs to undercover police officers, including cocaine and opium, or a derivative. In the most recent case, the charges included selling the drugs near a school, and he is being held on $50,000 bail. The best part? All four times that he had been arrested, it has been by the same undercover officer. Wow. Was the undercover officer a master of disguises? Or is this guy just an idiot? I almost made him the idiot of the week because that's just really dumb. I mean, this is why they call it dope. But I didn't call him the idiot of the week because that comes later. In any case, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. As a director and producer, Roger Corman put his stamp on hundreds of classic creepy movies starring wasp women, carnivores, and sharktopus clones. He also helped launch the career of some of the best actors and directors around. And Beverly Gray spent nearly a decade as Roger's story editor. She's also the author of Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampire, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers. And she joins us on the line from New York City. Hi, Beverly.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. Roger certainly was an innovator, is still an innovator as far as an indie producer and director is concerned, turning out some great works. Were people, first of all, what time period were you working with Roger?
Okay, just to lay out his whole career, he started in 1956 and he's still at it. I worked for him in two different periods, and the first was a very interesting period at a place called New World Pictures. I was there from 1973 to 1975 when he was just starting his own film production and distribution company. So he was no longer directing, but he was producing some movies that are today called classics. The number one among those was Death Race 2000, which I worked on, as well in that same year as films like Big Bad Mama with Angie Dickinson, a very interesting kind of weird movie called Cockfighter, and the immortal Candy Stripe Nurses, where I have a cameo.
Okay, so at that time period in the 70s, it was just after,
yeah,
or not too far after, the studios had lost their grip on certainly on the actors and some of the directors. The studio system was going away. The indie situation was building, but It was also a time where, unfortunately, we also saw some, for lack of a better term, accountants coming in running Hollywood, as opposed to people like Roger and his ilk, who were showmen, who were artists, who were filmmakers, who knew how to make money creatively as opposed to just making money, correct?
Correct. That's absolutely right. One other thing I want to point out about Roger is the films that he was making, the early monster movies and horror movies, a lot of the young kids watching those movies became some of Hollywood's most important directors and filmmakers themselves. I'm talking about people like Francis Ford Coppola, like Steven Spielberg. Some of them worked for him, but all of them watched his horror movies and were inspired so that, for instance, it was said in the New York Times when Jaws came out and took the nation by storm. After all, what is Jaws but a Roger Corman movie on a big budget? What people were discovering was that you could make a Roger Corman-type Monster from the Deep movie, spend somewhat more on advertising, somewhat more on effects, a lot more on distribution, and you could make a whale of a lot of money. When we look around at today's cartoon hero, comic book hero kinds of genres, they've really got Roger Corman written all over them, but they've spent a whole lot more money to do it.
You say inspirational. He was an inspiration to many. What
yes.
was it, in your estimation, that made Roger so inspirational to others in the directing and acting community?
Several things. One of the things is that so many of them worked for him, so they learned how to do it from him. They learned how to please the public. They learned to cater to the youth market. And I'm talking about all these various assistants of his, like Francis Ford Coppola, like Martin Scorsese, Jonathan Demme did the first film for him, James Cameron. Ron Howard, of course, had been a TV star, but as a director, he got the opportunity to direct a movie for the first time for Roger Corman. So that was one kind of inspiration. Another kind was just that Roger's movies were never snooty. They were never pompous in any way. They were smart, but not intellectual, if you understand what I mean. They were full of excitement, some humor, some attractive women taking their clothes off, things that are certainly still with us.
So the one thing, I mean, in the introduction, I mentioned some of the things that he had in his movies. The subtitle of your book, Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers, also talks about some of the things that show up in his movies. What was it that Roger saw in these things that he got? In other words, a lot of times people would come in and say, oh, no, that's just too far-fetched. What was far-fetched for Roger?
Not very much. Roger loved to be ahead of the curve. One of his favorite words through the years, and I should mention that in addition to working for him in the 70s, I also worked for him in a very fertile period when video was burgeoning, 1986 to 1994. And in all of that period, one of his favorite adjectives was the word wild. He loved things that were wild, that were a little bit out there, that were a little more bold than the studios were willing to do. For instance, there was a period where Steven Spielberg was making Jurassic Park, and everybody knew that that had been a huge novel and was going to be a really big movie. And people were just dying to see this exciting movie with lots of special effects about dinosaurs running around in the modern world. And Roger said, how can I make Jurassic Park on my kind of budget and make it cheaper and make it faster so that it comes into the theaters before Jurassic Park, and so people who are just dying to see this dinosaur run amok movie go to see mine first. And of course, he spent a lot less money. The movie is a lot less carefully crafted. How could it be carefully crafted? It was made in 3 weeks or so in terms of the principal photography, and it was gotten together very quickly. But it was wilder, it was stranger, it was faster, and it was in the movie theaters first. So for Roger, that was a victory.
Okay, so with such an illustrious career, and everyone lauds his work to a certain degree, what would Roger Corman be like if he were working for a studio and a big budget? Or would he succeed? Or would he want to?
You know, he tried that. He tried that both as a young filmmaker. He started to go that route and was always, you've got to understand that Roger is a guy who, it's not just a matter of being prudent. I think he physiologically, psychologically can't spend money. So when the studios would give him a big list of all the stuff they were sending to a set, I'm thinking of a particular film, a Western he was going to make, and they said, we'll send you two generators and this and that. And he started crossing things off his list because he said, I don't need all that. Well, the studios got really nervous at this sort of stripped-down idea of his. But he just, this was not his money. He was rejecting the use of other people's money because no matter what, for Roger Corman, waste is waste. So that's one thing that happened when you look for the studios. And much later, I was privileged in the 90s to work on the first film he made as a director since about the year 1970. And it was a movie called Frankenstein Unbound. One of Roger's many, many alumni, a producer named Tom Mount, who had made some money making movies like Bull Durham and Tequila Sunrise, decided that Roger Corman really should be directing again, that he really should be back in the saddle as a director. And Tom got the money together, made a studio co-production to take some kind of a Frankenstein story, put Roger's name on it, Roger Corman's Frankenstein Unbound, and see what Roger could do. And he really, this was a pretty top-drawer production, far more money than Roger had ever spent on a movie. It doesn't sound like much now. I think it was $12 or $15 million, but for Roger, that was an enormous amount of money. And John Hurt was in the cast, and Bridget Fonda was in the cast, and Raul Julia, people who are solid, respected Hollywood actors, really good craftspeople, cinematographer, music, fantastic poster, sent Roger off to Italy to make this movie. And Roger just had a tough time spending that money. And it made him really uncomfortable, even though, again, the money was not his. He was paid $1 million to make this movie, which is why he decided not to turn down the assignment. But talking to Tom later, I found out that Roger just couldn't bring himself up to that level where more money was spent, with, of course, the idea of a more elaborate, more elegant production.
What is Roger better at, directing or producing?
You know, that's a really good question, and people don't generally ask me that. Certainly, he spent a lot more of his life producing. He is a craftsman. He knows that as a producer, he's always been a very hands-on producer. I mean, he will be there in the editing room looking over the shoulder of the editor. He will have a lot to do with the original decision when he's in the mood to do it, because as he's gotten older, he's not always in the mood, and we'll delegate. But when he buckles down and gets involved with the story or gets involved with the script or gets involved with production, post-production, he's very good at it. He's definitely a craftsman. And in some of his films, like After the Red Death, for instance, there is some real artistic style to them, which a good director, of course, brings to a movie. But producing seems to be the thing that's the most natural for him, just being the big decision maker, the big business brain, the one who decides. So I guess I've got to say that's where he's best.
I've got less than a minute, so I have to ask you this last question. Your book, Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers. When you sat down to write this book, were you writing it as for the person who is a big Roger Corman fan, and this would be a love letter to his fans, or were you writing it for the person who maybe doesn't know who Roger Corman is and should learn more?
Am I allowed to say both?
Sure.
This is a third edition. The book first came out in the year 2000 and was a bestseller in L.A., where people really, I think even people within the industry, were trying to figure this guy out. So a lot of people who were attracted to the book knew the name, knew some of the accomplishments, but like a lot of the rest of us, even those of us who worked for him for years, have never quite understood what made him tick. So there are other books about Roger out there, and they have some colorful, you know, lots of production stories and photos and so on. But this book is a great deal more of an analysis of a very complicated man. And I've found it, it's attractive even to people who started out really not knowing much about him.
Okay, one very last question, very simple to answer.
Yeah.
In the even though he's had such an illustrious and amazing career in the industry, is Roger Corman underrated?
I think not anymore. He got an honorary Oscar in 2009, and that was a love letter. People like Ron Howard, people like Jonathan Demme and Quentin Tarantino were standing up and making lengthy speeches in his honor. So I think people have come to recognize him, partly out of gratitude because he gave so many people, and not just the famous ones, their start, but also his accomplishments as a maker of film. So I don't think he's unappreciated now, but he's 87 years old and still making movies, really not very good movies in many cases, but he's still making them. So just that kind of longevity, that kind of sense of him as a part of the past has really made people become very affectionate about Roger, which they might not have been at an earlier date.
The book is called Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers, written by Beverly Gray. Beverly, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Just a pleasure. Great talking to you.
Beverly Gray, author of Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers. Her website is beverlygray.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0219, and you'll find links to Beverly's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Afterlife, True Tales of the Wandering Dead. And we'll also meet the author of When It Comes to Spooning, I'm a Fork. Plus, of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get back to the stuff right here, right now, shall we? Three men were driving near Sanford, Florida, when one needed to pee. They pulled over, and Brandon Rappe, age 18, got out to relieve himself. That's when the other two guys saw a snake. No, really, they saw a real snake, and decided to shoot it. Jared Hemphill, age 18, grabbed a rifle, but when he turned back, he didn't see the snake. He did, however, hear a sound or a noise in the bushes and opened fire, shooting Rappe in the thigh. When he saw what he had done, Hemphill dropped the rifle and threw Rappe in the car to take him to the hospital. Deputies found the rifle at the scene. Rappe refused to press charges, so deputies let Hemphill go. Which does not, of course, mean that Rappe will, because you know the old saying, revenge is a dish best served cold. Meanwhile, a man in Decatur, Alabama, called 911 to report gorillas in his yard, then left the line open. He never came back on the phone, said police spokesman Lieutenant John Crouch. That's why the dispatcher heard the gunshots. Officers responded and found the man uninjured, but with a shotgun that had been fired several times, apparently from a recliner inside his home into a wall. It appeared he was shooting at something he thought was inside the house, Crouch said. He was taken into custody without incident, and no charges will be filed at this time. The man declined to be taken to hospital, but a mental health officer ordered it anyway. Time for a checkup from the neck up. You know, I just want you to know that no gorillas were injured in the telling of this story. But I now have a hankering to watch Rise of the Planet of the Apes again. Anyway, shall we get to the Darwin file? Yes, that's always fun. Investigators were perplexed when a landscaping business in New Hampshire exploded at 1:30 in the morning. Two bodies were found in the destroyed building, but neither was the landscaper. They were apparently burglars. The state fire marshal figured out what happened. Lucas Burke, age 21, and Ethan Keeler, age 20, were using a blowtorch to break into a safe inside the shop. What was inside, you ask? Fireworks. The resulting blast blew their bodies apart, said Thomas Komisarek, who owns the business. Once morning broke, Komisarek excused himself. He said, I have to go to work. There's nothing else I can do. Now, there's a strong work ethic, huh? I mean, because, you know, the boss never gets a day off without pay. And as for the two victims, you know what I always say about the Darwin file. Yes, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Troopers from the Illinois State Police swarmed the Kennedy Expressway to target people texting while driving. They ended up giving out 135 tickets for distracted driving, which carries, by the way, a $120 fine, even though they posted signs warning of the operation. But one man was let off with a warning. He wasn't texting while driving, but rather shaving. He was trying to multitask, said State Police Lieutenant David Byrd. And I love this next quote by the lieutenant. He said, at least it was an electric shaver and not a bowl of water and shaving cream. Yeah. And by getting off with just a warning, he didn't have to work himself up into a lather. Yeah. And finally, on our final story in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a woman in Redding, California, called police to say she thought her boyfriend had been abusing her 4-year-old son. They met her at a hospital as requested, but it didn't take much investigation to clear the boyfriend. What she thought were signs of abuse turned out to be diaper rash, which police attributed to the mother's neglect of her son. Contributing to that, they say, is her apparently being a meth addict. She appeared high to the officers, who noted that a container of apparent meth fell out of her shirt. She admitted that she had been awake for 4 days and not taking care of her son or cleaning the house. The 22-year-old woman was arrested and charged with methamphetamine possession and child endangerment. Her name, by the way, Zara Crank. Couldn't make that up if I tried. Now, what I'd like to know is, if she didn't need any sleep, then why was the house a mess? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Jay Pedno is the author of Afterlife, True Tales of the Wandering Dead. It's a compilation of real post-mortem adventures. He's also the man behind the website, thehumanmarvels.com. And Jay joins us on the line via Skype-to-Skype communications from Toronto. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you?
The concept of the compilation of stories, it's really interesting that you talk about real post-mortem adventures. Some people might call this kind of creepy.
It could definitely border on that sort of material, absolutely, but it's actually more interesting, I find, just in the fact that, you know, people kind of have these concepts of what happens after, you know, you cease to be. And so when something happens that goes against the expected, it just kind of sparks that curiosity, I think.
Well, how did your interest in all of this start?
Basically, I was a circus sideshow entertainer. I'm a historian of unusual history. In my website, I basically chronicle the lives of extraordinary people. So it's kind of a natural extension to go from these lives of extraordinary people to the afterlives of extraordinary people as well.
Well, let's back up just a bit. How does one actually become a circus sideshow entertainer?
Lots of stupidity and time. I just kind of always had an interest in unusual things, so I kind of taught myself how to do unusual things with my body. I'm a made freak, as they say. I wasn't born one; I was made one. So I still do occasional performing here in Toronto. I do a bi-monthly show with a friend of mine who's a mind reader. So we kind of do a duo tag team of a variety show type show.
Okay, so you just described a made freak as opposed to born freak. Mm-hmm. So when you work in sideshows, is there a difference, a discrepancy between those two groups you just described?
Sure. I mean, a born freak would be an individual who was born different. So basically human oddity or, I like to call them human marvels. A made freak is someone who's learned their profession. So sword swallowers, fire eaters, that sort of thing. Those are the sort of people that would be called a made freak.
Okay. Now, let's get to the book,
sure.
Afterlife, True Tales of the Wandering Dead. What are some of the things one can find in the book?
I cover all the bases as far as I go all the way back to mummification. So the history of mummy commerce. I don't know if you're aware, but mummies were used for all sorts of things, everything from medicine to paint pigments. Up until the 1920s, you could still actually buy mummy fragments in art supply catalogs. They would use the little chips and fragments to create paints. So a lot of like the masterpieces that you'd see in the Louvre or things like that actually have bits of people actually in the painting themselves. So I start with that. I also go into quite a bit of the history of grave robbing for medical purposes. There's with medicine, there was always a shortage of bodies to work on. So grave robbing actually became a very huge industry. And actually, because of these grave robbers, I mean, medicine was, put forward many, many years. It would have actually been slowed down a lot if it hadn't been for these grave robbers. Or grave robbers, actually, one of the terms I like to hear is some of the medical professionals would call them resurrectionists, because it was a lot more palatable than grave robber, I guess.
I like to refer to them as unauthorized archaeology.
That's a good one too, absolutely, or corpse displacement technician.
It sounds like almost everything in your book could be every second episode of Criminal Minds.
I suppose it could be, absolutely, yeah. So as far as like I have those kind of broad topics, and then I also go delve into specific stories of specific individuals that went on to fame, fortune, after their life.
Now you have also come up with an interesting way to get your book published, correct?
Correct. I'm going the Kickstarter route. Yes.
And how's that working out for you?
So far, so good. I believe I have another 10 or so days. I'm getting close to 40% now. I know there's usually a kind of a builds up speed towards the end, so I'm kind of counting on that. If not, I have a few backup plans, but I really like the idea of crowdsourcing. It's kind of Darwinian almost. These projects are kind of supported by the masses, and the ones that are successful are the ones that people support.
And for those who aren't too familiar with crowdsourcing, there's a give and take. People give you money to get whatever product is you are doing, and in return they get something. So besides the book, what are they getting from you for being part of your crowdsource?
Basically, there's the book, of course. There's also things like everyone that pledges above $10 gets a postcard that I personally autograph and then write a note of thanks in. So there's a postcard, limited edition. There's art prints. There's T-shirts. I've joined forces with an old friend of mine, Rob Sicchetto, who's a very well-known artist in the zombie community, horror artist. He's actually doing all the chapter art for me, original chapter art, just to kind of keep my costs down, because procuring images from Library of Congress and that sort of thing, it gets kind of expensive. So I opted to go with all original art based on the chapters.
And I should mention right now, we've had Rob on the program several times, and his zombie work is just, zombie art is just amazing. So put that out there for those who are listening and are interested in the book and also his work as well. Give us some other examples of some of the things people can find on the book, some specific cases. Like, I understand there's one situation dealing with Eva Perón.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the body of Eva Perón was basically stolen and was kept ransomed for quite a while. So that's a big part of that as well. And also there's a large regiment around, you know, preserving her remains and things like that too. So that's an interesting story, which was kind of almost like a modern, well, semi-modern tale of body snatching. One of my favorite stories in the book is the story of Elmer McCurdy. I don't know if you've ever heard of Elmer McCurdy.
No, can't say that I have.
Elmer McCurdy was an outlaw in the turn of the last century, early 1900s, and he was shot down by police, and his body was unclaimed afterwards. And so what ended up happening to Elmer was he was embalmed by the local funeral home and placed in their window as kind of an example of their craftsmanship, which isn't that unusual. That was actually a fairly common practice at the time. What happened after that, though, was, again, sideshow comes into it. A circus owner came by, purchased the body, and began displaying it. Now, from 1911 onwards, Elmer McCurdy passed hands. He appeared in a couple of films. He appeared in different dime museums, things like that. And then at some point, people just kind of forgot that Elmer was a real person. So in the 70s, he actually ended up as a prop in a California funhouse. Spray-painted bright orange, real human remains. And he was actually discovered. The only reason he was discovered was because one of the crew of the $6 Million Man TV show was actually filming in this funhouse, dropped the remains, and there was a human bone in this prop that he broke, which turned out to be Elmer McCurdy.
Sounds like a really sad version of Weekend at Bernie's.
Pretty much, without the voodoo and the comedy. Yeah.
Wow. You must hear from people who say, Jay, this is a little too ghoulish.
Yeah, you know what? It is ghoulish, but at the same time, again, I mean, it's human nature to be curious. And I find that every time I talk to anybody about this subject, you know, I'll shoot one story out there and they're asking me for more. Because, again, it's just human nature to be curious about, you know, the unknown, and then what bigger unknown is there than you know, afterlife.
Mm. The book is called Afterlife, True Tales of the Wandering Dead. How can people go about getting the book?
If you go to Kickstarter, type in Wandering Dead. You can also go to my website, themanmarbles.com. You can also find it on Facebook. Pretty much anywhere that there is internet access, you could probably type in the title of my book or my name, and you will find it popping up. I'm working really hard to get the word out.
Jay, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
Jay Pedno, author of Afterlife, True Tales of the Wandering Dead. Again, you can check out his website at thehumanmarvels.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0219, and you'll find the links. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. If you ask a child what their favorite part of the school day is, chances are they'll tell you it's recess. There's nothing wrong with that either. A lot of learning and growing takes place on the playground. The games aren't just fun, they build confidence and help children become comfortable with risks. Experts tell us that risk-taking on the playground is extremely important to child development, but nowadays, children are losing many of the opportunities that you and I had for conquering our fears. Things like monkey bars and tall slides are vanishing because of lawsuits, and earlier this month, two schools in New York and New Hampshire actually banned the age-old game of tag. Let's be fair. By allowing too many lawsuits, American courts have helped create a situation where many simple playground games are no longer allowed. Safety is important, but recess today can actually stunt development and leave children with anxieties that are far worse than a broken bone. It's time to demand better. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
You're experiencing the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of When It Comes to Spooning, I'm a Fork, and of course there is an idiot of the day, but we still have a few Stuff File stories to get through before we get to that point. After consulting with a lawyer, Evan Dobell, president of the Massachusetts Westfield State University, accused of billing the state of unauthorized travel expenses, is reportedly considering claiming that he actually self-reported the violations as soon as suspicions turned up. Dobell says that he would thus be entitled to the protection of the state whistleblower status, which shields inside informers when they expose wrongdoing. Wow, he really has a pair on him, or should I say, his lawyer has a pair for coming up with that ultimate chutzpah defense. And this makes perfect sense to this next guy. A 77-year-old motorist told police in Kagawa Prefecture in Japan that he was going the wrong way on the Takamatsu Expressway only because he had missed his exit 1 kilometer back and thought it was best just to turn the car around and retrace the path back to the ramp. Police say his short September jaunt had caused a collision, but not affecting his own car. You know, just going on the theory that this guy thinks that explanation makes sense is reason enough to take his license away forever. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our last guest, in September, an appeals tribunal reinstated Gwent, Wales police officer Sean Jenkins, age 36, who was fired in 2010 for having sex with a woman while on duty. The head of a police court concluded that Jenkins was on an authorized break at the time, no more improper than stopping for a spot of tea. Investigators originally found it appalling that Jenkins was out of uniform during the escapade, but he pointed out that his gun remained on his person at all times, albeit around his ankles. Yes, well, everybody deserves a break time, but wait a minute. Aren't breaks usually very short? Yeah, all this attention can't be good for his ego. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Prey is the author of When It Comes to Spooning, I'm a Fork, a humorous look at marriage and parenting. Mark joins us on the line right now from Michigan to share his vital tips. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. I want to start right off the bat with the title, When It Comes to Spooning, I'm a Fork. You got to explain that one to us.
Sure. Well, that's actually taken from one of the chapters in one of the stories in the book, and it's probably the story that I've had the most response to over the years, and when I decided to put these stories into book form, it just seemed to make a lot of sense to utilize that as the title of the book as well, and it kind of encapsulates, you know, what the book is about, which is, you know, my sort of take on marriage and on parenting and my foibles as a husband and a father, and in this particular case relates to early on in my marriage, and my wife would try to one way or another get me to spoon with her to go to sleep at night. That was sort of her preferred position for falling asleep, and what I discovered quickly was that I could not fall asleep like that, and so I started making excuses, to avoid that position, the dreaded spooning position, and eventually I just blurted out one night, you know, maybe the problem is that you're a spoon and I'm a fork, and we just don't fit together correctly, and after she punched me and rolled over and went to sleep, I knew that was going to be another story. At the time, I was writing a blog about my life, and that was going to be my weekly post. and that's something that I have not lived down with her or other people that used to read the blog and that now read the book.
Well, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of guys out there who are saying, okay, you made this statement, you got punched for it in the middle of the night. Why dredge it up again for your wife to see in the as the title of a book? What does she say about it?
Yeah, she's been very supportive. You know, I think the thing about the book is, you know, if you laugh at anyone in the book, you laugh at me, you know, and that was sort of my purpose was, you know, I don't mind being sort of the clown and the butt of the joke. So I tried to, you know, I think she comes off maybe better than I do, and that's intentional, and it's probably accurate to our real lives as well, as I'm kind of, you know, going by the seat of my pants here, and therefore I mess up frequently, and she lets me know when I've messed up, and I, you know, try to learn from those mistakes and go forward. And so the only request she had to me when I was putting together this these stories into a book format was she asked me if to make her come off as thinner, and I don't know if I did that or not, but that other than that, she's been very supportive.
The type of writing that you do and the topics that you discuss, would you consider yourself sort of like the male version of Irma Bombeck?
A little bit, yeah. I'm sort of like if Tim Allen had, you know, was writing a book about, you know, his life and as a parent and a father, I kind of think or envision that this is what he would probably you know, write. It's something that he would, you know, it'd be very self-deprecating and funny and very indicative of him as a man and how all of us men sort of we try to do the best we can and sometimes we are successful and sometimes we fail, but you just keep moving forward.
You mentioned Tim Allen, another Michigander. Must be something in the water there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm a big fan of his. I actually caught him when he was just starting out as a comedian, I'm going to say back in the late 1980s, and he was really, really funny then. And his act back then was very much, you know, related to what you saw in his first television show, in terms of, you know, his experience as a man and you know, and liking to build things and break things and take things apart and not being able to really figure out women and that sort of thing. And that was what his act was all about back then, and it was very funny then, and I think it still is.
Now, you, in addition to being married, you have two sons, correct?
Yes.
How old are they?
Yeah. Well, they are now 18 and 20.
Okay, so what do they say about what Dad has written, and what does that teach them about relationships?
Yeah, right. They've both read the book, and I started writing this blog, you know, pretty much when my oldest was born, and I wrote it for about, a number of years anyway, and the stories I would write, I try to write something every week about my experiences, you know, as a husband and a father. And so these stories started out really from the moment I first met my wife all the way through my older boy reaching his teenage years. So some of the stories I think they remember, and some obviously they wouldn't because they were, you know, from when they were very young. So I think they've had, you know, kind of gotten a kick out of, you know, reading about, you know, their lives, you know, from the point when they were just a twinkle in the eye, let's say, to when they were a little bit older. I think the later stories, I think they both recall them, hopefully fondly. So I think it's been kind of, you know, a neat thing for them to say, oh, this is I miss or don't remember this, but you know, it definitely doesn't surprise me that, you know, Dad did this or that this happened, and we've had some chuckles about it, to say the least.
Primarily, who are you going after as far as the market is concerned? By that I mean, Are you looking to reach men who commiserate with your goings on in the stories that you share in your book, or are you looking to reach women to explain guys?
Very good. I think both of those are goals of mine. I think the book really could appeal to anyone who is married, that's male or female, or is a parent, or anyone who is thinking of doing either of those things, getting married or becoming a parent. I think they can find something to relate to anybody in those circumstances, which is obviously a large segment of the population, and or even just anyone who likes a funny story well told. Hopefully they find it well told, would probably enjoy the book as well. And the one thing I've tried to do with these stories is again, they're very much taken from my own life, but I've always tried to work in, if not a lesson, at least sometimes something deeper than just something funny. To try to find some little bit of some nugget of deeper meaning, or something that can be taken out of the story and maybe utilized in someone's everyday life, as well as hopefully make people laugh.
You've been doing this for a while with your blog, as you mentioned, so your wife is obviously very used to all of this. But what about people in your wife's life? I mean, for instance, when either your in-laws or her relatives or her friends read what you write, do they see her or they go, oh, come on, Mark, you've gone too far?
Sometimes. Again, I try to, and it's because it's true to my life, I try to be the butt of the joke most often. So, but there are, I think, episodes in there and stories in the book that, where maybe we've both kind of been, wrong, and we've both kind of recognized that. But yeah, I've had certainly family members and friends, stop us and say, that I can't believe, that happened, or that was, that you've written about that, but I, I give you credit for doing it. But, and like I said, my wife is very, fortunately, very understanding and patient. So it's all good, as they say. If we can't laugh at ourselves, then we're doing something wrong.
It must make the holiday family gatherings interesting entertainment and conversation fodder.
Yeah. Well, even without the stories in the book, we tend to find ourselves laughing frequently and generating more, more information or more stories for future books, because, like I mentioned, I stopped the blog, and so the story sort of ended when my oldest reached his teenage years, and so it's been now close to 7 years since then. So if the book it finds an audience and people enjoy it, I will definitely consider writing a follow-up to cover that intervening period of time, because there's been some very interesting moments, to say the least, raising two teenage boys.
The book is called When It Comes to Spooning, I'm a Fork. It's written by Mark Prey. And Mark, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yes, it's been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. And, the book is available pretty much everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can find links as well from my website, which is markprey.com.
Mark Prey, author of When It Comes to Spooning, I'm a Fork. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0219, and you'll find links to Mark's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Roman Alla handed his car keys to a valet at the Pacific Place Shopping Center in Seattle, Washington. As the valet got into the car, he spotted a gun on the passenger seat. He refused to move the vehicle and called security, who then called the cops. The police arrived after Alla left, but quickly tracked him down. They searched his vehicle and say they found a stolen pistol sitting on top of nearly $20,000 in money orders. Now, because he's a convicted felon, Alla was charged with unlawful possession of a firearm. You know, it's always nice when those dumb enough to commit crime are also considerate enough to leave the evidence in plain view. I mean, why would you just leave a gun on a car seat and then hand the keys over to a valet parker, especially when you're already a convicted felon? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0219. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0219. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for this week's show. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.